treat, and I'll give you candy.
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. Enough of them around here. I'm always amazed with people who live here who come out to pick you up at the airport. And I want to thank Dan for doing that. You have a language. Every area has its own language. And Dan said, now, toughest part of this is getting out of the periphery. What's the periphery? He said, the airport. He said, could go north, could go south, could go east, could go west. I said, well, we just follow the signs, you know, like see where we're going. But it was a good, safe trip, and I'm really glad to be here, glad to be with Jerry and Kay and Jen and all the people I haven't seen in a while, and to meet a lot of new friends. I was here for Tammy's talk last night, and I bet two bail bondsmen cried when she got sober. You know, like that. honey, the kids ain't going to college. Tammy's going straight. You know, like. Love you, little cutie, but leaving is my duty. Enjoyed Andrew this afternoon, and I'm really happy to be sober, and really happy to be here with you guys. And Charles is over there. They announced that he's doing the taping, and all I can tell you is that this taping has become quite a phenomena in AA. I was down to we have a baseball park that just opened up, Petco Park in San Diego, and I was down at the ballpark with a couple of friends from work, and we were having a night out on the company because they have the tickets, and I haven't been a baseball fan since the Dodgers left Brooklyn, so we were watching the game, and the Padres were playing the Giants, San Francisco Giants, and the San Francisco Giants has a pinch hitter, and his name is Tony Tatata, and Tony was coming up, and of course I was doing my typical New York stupidness, you know, I'm there talking to these guys going, I hope Pony doesn't get a hit, you know what I mean? I hope Pony can't get out of the infield, you know? And I'm carrying on like a fool, and this guy in front of me turns around, and he says, you're Ken D. And I said, how do you know that? He said, I recognize you from your tapes. So I was there with, I said, guys from the company, and one guy who was only with us a short time. And so when this guy introduced me to his gal that he had just gotten engaged to, and we had a little conversation, and then the game went on, and this guy who had just come aboard with the company said, Ken, can I ask you a personal question? And I said, sure, go ahead. He said, I know from the owners that you have a kind of checkered past, and he said, did you ever do porno flicks? And of course, being a real alcoholic, I said, you know, I really'd rather not go into that right now. So I let him kind of linger with that from Friday night till Monday. But I'll tell you, Monday morning, he was hunting me down. I mean, he was like, hey, what the... Fill me in. And what you guys just did is the whole reason I like to come to these things. I love to hear people laugh, you know, I really do, because I know a couple of things about laughter that most people don't know, and that is you cannot laugh and think at the same time. So every time you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you, you know? If there were a song in AA, it would be, I'm always on my mind, I am always on my mind. You know, and the other thing about laughter is that the more you laugh, it produces endorphins. It produces a lot of these endorphins, and endorphins are real healthy for you. They help build up your immune system and fight off disease, and they give you a real good sense of health. And in fact, the Harvard Medical Institute said, next to sex, laughter is the number one producer of endorphins. So being a real alcoholic, I'm thinking, if you could have sex and laugh at the same time, you know, those babies would be a pumping and a pumping and a pumping. And, you know? And you say, wow, this is good stuff, you know? And I know the theme is see and share love. And that will be right after I'm done sharing, they'll have the dance. And I know they're going to have a 13-step dance, so as I'm winding down, I'll try to give you a high sign so that you can pick out your targets of opportunity. You know, you don't have to find Miss Right, just Miss Right Now, or maybe Miss Perhaps, or whatever, you know. And I know they'll play all that great music that's left over from the bars, you know. I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you, you know. Throw a saddle on the stove, mama. We're riding the range tonight, you know. And now they got this new one out that I hope you guys go to buy. You got to get this DVD. It's by a group called the Cherry Bombs. Anybody ever hear them? They got a new one out. And it says, it's hard to kiss those lips at night that chew your ass out all day long. You know what? So you want to be getting some of these things, some of these musical masterpieces, you know? And the main thing is I don't know how they do stuff here, but down in our area, it's like these dances are really, really interesting, you know? And sometimes they even lead to marriage, you know? I've been to marriages in AA where the only thing they have in common is neither one of them were raised by wolves, you know? Like, it's like they're just, you wonder, like, how are these two people going to make it? And some of them get married so many times, you know. I have guys that I sponsor actually have rice scars on their legs and stuff. You know, like, you know, they just, you know, they, you say hello, they say I do, you know. But it's always nice to be in sobriety and hear people laughing. You know, I know it wasn't like that for most people when they first got sober. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sobriety date is July 5th of 1970. Thank you. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I had all the poise of a hemophiliac going through a razor factory. You know, like, I was like all over the place. And my mom always thought my sobriety date was very appropriate because she said, you did everything on a fifth, you know, like, so this being your sobriety date is pretty good. And my mom loved me, but she never really understood me, you know. She would pick up beer cans and read the ingredients, and she said, I don't know what they put in here that makes you act so stupid, you know, like, and in my family, we're divided into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it, you know. There's no middle ground. My dad was dead at 50 behind this. I lost a brother and sister behind this. I mean, I've just been through that deal where I've seen people die behind this deal. But having said that and recognizing the seriousness of all of this, I'll tell you, it's sure glad and happy. I'm glad and happy to be able to laugh about a lot of this stuff. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, it was July 5th of 1970, and I went to a meeting, and as I walked into the meeting, they had greeters. You couldn't get into a meeting back in those days without a greeter. And the guy said, you're a newcomer. And that was before I knew you were intuitive and all that stuff. And I said, how do you know? He said, I just know. And he gave me a red name tag, and he said, come sit down front. That's where the miracle is. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I want the miracle. You know, like, And then, you know, it came to me later on, you know, I was wearing a blue wool suit on July 5th. You know? I had on a shirt and a tie and a vest, and everybody else was in shorts, pretty much like you guys this evening. And so, you know, I went and I sat down, and they had the meeting, and when the meeting was over, they took you to the diner. And they had a way of taking you to the diner. They put you on the inside of the booth, and then they kind of all squeeze in, you know. So you couldn't get out of that booth if you wanted to. You know, if there was a fire, you were last out, that's for sure. And I was there with two plumbers. I was there with a priest, an attorney, and a guy who was an FBI agent. And I thought, well, this is what it's come down to, you know, like people I thought could help me or people who were chasing me. Now we're having coffee, and they're in AA, you know, like, you know, I haven't had this much fun since I sprained my ankle, you know, like, and I'm thinking to myself, what the heck is happening here? And so the one plumber said to me, you know, Kent, I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. Good. I'm so excited about that. I can hardly contain myself, you know. And he died last year, and he was my temporary sponsor for 35 years. And I think he needed to work, to be honest with you, you know. Because, as my mom said, drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach. You know, I used to have thoughts in my head. I don't know if this ever happened to you guys. I have thoughts in my head that in my head sounded real good. But when they came out of my mouth, people would look at you. You know, like, he's out there where the buses don't run. You know, that boy is not the brightest bulb in the room, that's for sure. And like, even when I first got sober, I thought I'd make some money by selling hearing aids over the telephone. Telemarketing hearing aids, you know? Sounded good up here. And they used to, when I used to say, I've been thinking, they'd say, pace yourself, Ken. You got the whole day, you know? Like, you've got the whole day to do this, you know? And I, as I said, so I got into this thing, and I got just the right sponsor for me. He was a guy who was very grounded in the program, and if he gave me one of these right away, this is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know what this is the owner's manual. And when you get sober, you need an owner's manual, because from this point forward, no matter what question comes up, it's in this book. I'm always amazed at people asking questions that are so interesting, like, I'm having trouble with God. Well, why don't we read this, the chapter to the agnostic? You know, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea, you know. I'm having trouble with my family. Well, how about the family afterward? Wow, Ken, you got some good insight, you know. Like, and that's why I like to hang out with guys like that, because they got through school just like me, totally unscarred by education, you know, like... Education never landed a blow. You know, what was going on over here, I always managed to be over there, you know. I hung out with a guy, Vinny, and Vinny was just like me. The teacher in the fourth grade said to him, Vinny, how do you spell Mississippi? And Vinny said, you mean the river or the state, you know. So, you know, they're the kind of people you want to hang out with, because your own insanity goes totally unnoticed, you know. I mean, we were all the same way. You say, there's a dead bird, we look up. You know, like, that's just who we were, you know. That's just who we were. Guys would say, I mean, you'd be part of conversation where the guy would say, you know, Ken, I read where I'm only using 10% of my brain. And I'm only using 10% of my brain. What the hell am I doing with the other 60%? And I hang out with those guys today. I took a guy to get some bowling trophies, you know, for the bowling team that we're on. And he looks around, he goes, wow, is this guy good? Oh, he makes these, Donnie. Oh, yeah. So you get an idea. I mean, these were the kind of people I hung out with then and I hang out with now, you know. The other day, I was part of a conversation where a guy says, you know, Nikki, if your parents didn't have any children, there's a good chance you won't. So you get the idea of the world I live in, you know? That's why it's good to get away, you know? I get on a plane, I figure, hey, they're there, you know? And I know they'll be there when I get back, and I get a chance to come out here and meet some regular people in Georgia, you know, who are well-grounded, I know that. And so this guy was my sponsor, and he used to have me come over his house all the time. My wife had taken the kids and moved out of state for her own sanity and well-being, and I was like just hanging loose. And let me tell you, I was wound, spring-loaded when I came to AA. I was really not in a great place. And I remember this guy having me over his house, and he knew that I needed to be close to him and his family because it gave me a sense of continuity. And he gave me some meals, and I was eating on a regular basis then, and he just kept me close. And he was just this real solid citizen and just the kind of guy I needed. And then one night I was over there, and the phone rang, and he turned around, and he said, we got to go on a 12-step call. Now, prior to this, he had a nine-passenger station wagon. And I don't know if you remember those old station wagons, but the back seat faced out the back. And Fast Eddie, who was my kind of guy, and me, we used to have to sit in the back seat. And I used to say, why do we have to sit back here? And this guy used to say, because I want you to see the wreckage of your past. You know? So we would always have to sit in the back seat and look out the door. And so on this particular night, he says to me, we got a 12-step call. I said, good, good. Well, I need a 12-step call. You know, I haven't been on one yet. No, I had no idea what it was. You know, I was about 3 weeks sober. So he says, okay, let's go. So we go out to the car. I head for the back. He said, no, sit up front. I go, hey, this is starting to pay off already. I'm riding. I'll see what we're going to hit, you know. So we get in the car and we go out to this house on this 12-step call. And, of course, in the city, they always had cars triple park, double park. You can never get a parking space. So he said to me, Kent, I'm going to drive around the block. Can you go get this guy? And I said, hey, I can go get this guy. He said, no, I mean, can you go get this guy? And I said, hey, I'm alcoholic. I'm not retarded. You know, like, I can go get this guy. So he said, okay, go get him. So as he tells the story, when he came around the block and pulled up, I have the guy on the ground, and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid. Sometime between the time he made the call and we showed up, he had what's called a second thought, you know, which I have since found out he was entitled to, you know. But this was my first job in AA, and I didn't want to get off to a bad start, you know. Like, so when he said he changed his mind, I snagged him through the screen door, grabbed the garbage can lid, and, you know, I knew we were going to the meeting, so I didn't want to get too messed up. And so it wasn't like, I mean, I wasn't abusive. I hit him maybe two, three, four times tops. And I swear to this day that if Packy had not called me back into the car, that guy would have come. I could see after the second shot he was willing to turn his will and his life over to me because he said something like, please stop, don't hit me again. No. So Packy whistled me back into the car like I was a canine. So I got in the car and we take off down the avenue, and he looks over to me like he had a way of doing, and he said, I want you to do me two favors. I said, sure, what do you want me to do? I'm willing to help. And he said, first of all, don't ever consider that a 12-step call. He said, and secondly, he said, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor for a while. You know, like, let's see how this thing goes, you know. And so that was the start I got off to. But the thing that he did right away was he got me into this book, into the owner's manual. And we went through the steps just like they are in this book. We didn't have any ancillary papers. We didn't go to any seminars. We didn't have to take any special tutoring for it. We went through it just the way it is and how it works. And as we went through it, something phenomenal happened to me, and that is, I was evicted from my hiding places. All this time that I was making up characters to play roles in life, I got evicted from. And for the first time, I mean the really first time, I got to see who I was. And I got to see it without all the decoration and all the trim. And it was really an eye-opening experience to me. And it was something where these guys that I was hanging out with, as dingy as they were in some ways, they were really grounded in the text of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they used to have you read stuff, like read the doctor's opinion so you can find out who you are, you know. And Silkworth was a very interesting guy. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he worked with a lot of alcoholics. And he kind of just summarized us by saying, you know, we were in full flight from reality, you know. Outright mental defectives, creators of chaos, even in our best moments. You know, this is a lot to build with, you know, like you've got a lot going for you here, you know, like, you know, an outright mental defect, though. Hey, doctor, give me a break, you know. Now, I had to make known to my sponsor that when I was in high school, I was court ordered to a psychiatrist. And I was court ordered to a psychiatrist because I was having incidents in high school with anger that you shouldn't have. I could black out behind anger the same way I could black out behind booze. And so I had gotten into a couple of incidents where they said, you need some attention. And my dad was dead at that time. I was running numbers, and my mom had 7 kids. And so I went to the psychiatrist, and he said to me, what are you thinking right now? After we were there a little bit. And I made something up. And he said, no, that's not what you're thinking. Tell me what you're thinking right now. And what I was thinking right at that moment is, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? And somehow I intuitively knew not to share that with him, you know? I think had I shared that with him, I wouldn't be your speaker tonight. I'd be down at CMH making baskets or something, you know? But I had that kind of a mind going on all the time. You know, a guy said, Nay, what do you think you should do first to make money? I said, I should patent something. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I think I'm going to do this. I'm going to starch ties like this and sell them. And that way, even if you're not doing anything, you look busy, you know? And they would say, Ken, you know, sit down for a minute. You know, like, this, you know, you're going to have a little trouble raising funds to support some of your ideas, you know? Like, but this is just what would go on. I would hear something, and then I would translate it in my own language. It was like real knowledge would come into my head, and then somehow I would turn it around to make it something else. And I did that, you know, amazingly well in school. The teachers used to look at me. I remember a teacher one time said, Ken, tell us all you know about the Civil War. It won't take you very long. And without missing a beat, I said, hey, Mrs. Hendrickson, why don't you tell us all you know? It won't take you any longer. You know, like, and I'd always be in the principal's office. And he'd always say to me, again? You know, like, it was like I just kept showing up. I got booted out of parochial school because the nuns and I, they wanted to run the show. And I thought other control was needed at times. So. But I'd have no problem with the church or the nuns, even though I think the one incident I had there scarred me for life. And that incident was one day in the third grade, right before I got booted, I saw 2 dogs getting it on. And I said to the nun, what are they doing? And she said, they're dancing. And I said, sister, they're not even facing one another. You know, like, you know? And to this day, I'm marked by that experience. I am marked by that. I can be doing anything. I can be just so in the moment, spiritual. I mean, I could float away. And then they start playing the bunny hop. And I hear the music go, da-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na, and I know they're going to get to that, and I'm out of the seat, I'm on the end of the line, I'm going, sister, this is it, you know, like, you know. But the idea is that I've learned a lot in AA, and what I've learned most is, and this has really taken me a while to get to this, is that you can live a good life once you understand certain things, and one of them is, you cannot do anything about those things you can't do anything about. Oh, you guys know that already, huh? Yeah. It took me 12, 15 years to figure that out. I'd be saying, I can't do anything about it. Now, here's my plan, you know, like. And the other thing is, you live a real good life if you don't scratch shit that don't itch. You know, like if you just say, hey, you know, like, it's not really bothering me, just take a pass on it, you know? And my last great lesson was, you cannot shine shit. It just won't take a buff. You know, like, it's just, you can deodorize it and you can package it, but don't try to buff it because it's just not going to happen. And I went through life trying to do all of those things. You know, I would, I was just one of those people who just had my own little thoughts about things. I married a gal who was as normal as the dry cycle on the drying machine when I first married her. She was as normal as you could be. And she would say things to me, and I would look at her like, how can you have a conversation with this woman? You know? She would say things like, that's your second drink.
Ooh.
And I would say, honey, why don't you just forget about me and go ahead and finish your breakfast? You know, like, this is all going to be okay. You know, just you focus on the Cheerios and let me focus on what else. And I remember one time I came home from New York on the subway and I said to her, I got to have a drink. And she said, why? I said, the stock market had its worst day. And I'm pouring a couple of shooters and downing them. And she looks at me and she says, we don't own any stock. You know, how could you possibly have interaction with somebody like that? You know, like, there was no, I mean, she was always like right in the moment and right on target and perfectly healthy. And I used to think, God, I love her. You know, life must be very boring like that. You know, like, there was no drama. There was no excitement. It was just, this is the way it is. And I never saw it the way it is. You know, if I was here, I wanted to be there. If it was now, I wanted it to be then. If you were going right, I wanted to go left. If you were standing up, I sit down. If you were standing down, I sit down. I mean, like, I never wanted to do what everybody else was doing. You know, it was like I was a piano player in a marching band. You know, like, give me it. I'm play it along. You know, like, hey, take a flute. No, I don't want the flute. You know, but that's just the way I went on. And it just did that kind of stuff to me. And I had all these basic tendencies long before I picked up a drink. And I started drinking. People say they remember their first drink and all. God love you. I don't. My brother was a bartender, and I used to be able to go into the bar. You could drink legally in New York at 18. I used to be able to go in the bar about 14, 13 after school and shoot pool and mostly darts, play pinochle, and have a few beers. And if you said to me, what's the first date you remember doing that, I couldn't tell you. It didn't do any of this stuff to me where it just set me off. I was just an Irish Catholic kid who was just getting in the system, you know. You know, and it was just that way. And I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. That should have been a dead giveaway. We're the only Irish family in an all-Italian neighborhood. You know, people used to say, how far is it to the subway? We say, we don't know. No one's ever made it. You know, like... they used to have these little things they'd say like, hey, you fell asleep in the trunk of a car? You deserve to be shot. You know, like... So it was just that kind of a world. And when I got with this guy who was taking me through the steps and working with me and getting sober, he had me focused on the simplicity of this book. There's some really great lines in this book. Like there's one that says, surely this must be the answer, self-knowledge. But then the very next line says, but it is not. You know, it just isn't. It doesn't matter what you know about yourself. It's what are you going to do with that knowledge? You know, what are you going to do with that? You know, alcoholics open, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you open the refrigerator, you take the milk, you take a swig, and it's sour. And so you put it back in the refrigerator. You know, like, maybe tomorrow will be a better day, you know. Like, the miracle of milk will happen during the night, you know. And that's just the way I was, you know. I did all that dopey stuff. It was just, I had no idea what was going on. And people used to kind of bring it to your attention. My mom just never wanted me to be sitting and thinking in the living room. And she went through the living room. I hear kids today say to parents, say, turn off the TV and work on projects and stuff. My mom would say, turn on the TV. The last thing she wanted me to do is sit there and think. Because I tell you, it really happened to me when I was thinking. You know, I was like the original crawl on CNN. There was constantly something going by, you know. Like, and then I figure I'm going to catch one of these and just get on it. You know, like, I never had trouble getting people to follow me. My problem was I didn't know where the hell I was going. You know, like, but I could get people riled up and then go. And then it's like, whoa. You know, I used to walk into a bar and it would be like a drum roll. People would say, let the games commence. You know, Ken's here, because it was like something was going to happen. And when I got to that first AA meeting, I had just been in a bar fight. I had questioned somebody's ancestry. And, you know, it looked like I was in a gang war and my gang didn't show up. You know, like I had one of those barroom facials wearing this suit that my nose was here and all. And did you ever have those conversations in the emergency room at 3 in the morning where somebody who's a professional person, a medical person, is trying to help you and they say, "How did this happen?" Yeah, let me tell you. Yeah. I went to the bathroom. He took my stool. And when I came back, I hit him. I didn't know he was part of the police department, you know? Like, and then like setting your nose and, you know. And when the cops in New York arrested you, they always read you your rights. They told you your rights. You have the right to remain silent. I never had the ability. You know, I had the right. I just never had the ability. I always had, hey, you know, you could be making some real arrests on criminals. And, you know, and in the meantime, they'd be putting you in the back of the car. And they always had that decision that if you were a nice guy, they'd bend your head and slide you in. If you were a pain in the patuta, like I usually was, they introduce you to the top of the roof. Like, you know, when you went to night court, you always say, "And look what they did here." I was minding my own business, and look what he did. Yeah. And so the deal is that I was so primed for AA when I got here. It was amazing to me how primed I was. And as we did the steps and we went through this stuff and we got very, very much into the book, I began to realize that all of my life I thought I'm going to live my life in such a way that I'm going to make my mother proud, and when I die, someone's going to write a book about me. And they did. It's called The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm on every page, you know. I have guys that read this. A guy read this the other day. So I said, "What are you reading?" He said, "I'm reading the chapter to the antagonistic." That's my guy, you know. I love these guys. I love hanging out with people where, as I said, your own insanity goes totally unnoticed. And you know that really what life is about today is perception. You know, it always was about perception. But when you were drinking, did you ever notice how it always seemed like somebody or something was getting more than you? Or, you know, your perception was screwed up. And now, hopefully today, my perception is pretty good. I keep a positive attitude. I pray for a positive attitude. You know, I'm the kind of guy now that, you know, one of those guys that you say, you know, my wife cut me down to sex once a month, but hey, I'm not even upset. Some guys she cut out altogether. So, you know, like, so you want to keep a real positive kind of attitude. You know, that's the deal. And it doesn't matter what's going on. You just want to be in the moment and do this moment. I have guys that will tell me in the first step that they're powerless, that their lives are unmanageable and they're powerless, which is basically what it says. And then in the third step, they'll tell you they don't want to turn it over. You say, "Well, wait a second, what are you turning over? You already admit you don't have any power. So you're arguing about giving up something you don't have in the first place. Does this make sense?" You know? And I like the look that they get. You know, it's kind of like a dog on the freeway. It's like, you know, the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning, you know? Like, and people don't understand. You're not giving up anything. And most alcoholics spend their whole day, you know, trying to escape a reality they're not in. You know? Trying to solve problems they don't have, you know? You know, and you say, "Well, you know, that's like housekeeping in a dream. You know, like it serves no purpose." And you hear people say, "Well, I had a busy day. You know, the three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, "I've been thinking." You know, like you might as well just say, "Let the games commence," because you know whatever comes next is going to be really good. You know, alcoholics go to a wedding; they want to be the bride. You know, they go to a funeral, they want to be the corpse. You know, they want to be the center of attention, but at the same time, they want to practice humility, you know? And you just watch these guys and you say, this is really entertaining, you know? this is really entertaining. It's like watching a dog, you know. It's like watching a dog get bit by a cat. You know, it's like you just watch this stuff. And you say to them, this stuff isn't rocket surgery. You know, it's not that heavy. You know, like, you know, just pace yourself. You know, just try to do one page at a time, maybe, until you get a feel, you know, and then you can build up momentum. And then maybe go a page and a half or something. But it tells you in there, people say, I'm looking for God. You're wasting your time. You're wasting your time because God is omnipresent, which means God is present all the time. So you can't be looking for something that's already here. That's the beginning of the problem. The thing you want to do is follow what the book says, and that is, as you become conscious of his presence, you'll lose your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. You'll be reborn. And you'll be reborn into living in this moment, because this is the only moment we can live in. You know, most alcoholics of my type are trading this moment to get to some other moment that we think is going to be better. And in the meantime, we never enjoy the things we have in this moment. We can't enjoy them because we're constantly in a plot to get to the next moment. And I'm a real alcoholic. I don't know if you guys are real. I'm a real alcoholic. You know, I drank stuff that not only hit the spot, it removed it. You know, like, you know. It's like you know, people say, well, some people see the glass as half full. Some people see the glass as half empty. I always saw the glass as too small. You know, like, it's just the fact that I started to read in this book, and what happened to me was I looked at words, and I'm an avid reader. I'm totally unscarred by education, but I love to read. I love to read all kinds of stuff. And I began to read the words in this book, and I looked at that word spiritual. It's a spiritual program. And inside the word spiritual is the word ritual, R-I-T-U-A-L. And what I realized is if I was going to get spiritual, I would have to develop a ritual. And that ritual would be to stay sober on a daily basis, to work with others, and do some fundamental things, because that was going to allow me to grow. And I didn't have a ritual. I mean, I'd get up in the morning with absolutely no plans at all, and then fill in the day as I went along, you know. And I don't say the flip side of that is to take a legal pad and plan your whole day out either. I just say that throughout the day now, I stop doing things for various periods of time throughout the day, because if I'm going to ask God to direct me, I got to allow time to hear that. And that means I don't carry a cell phone. Now, I know that's antithesis in America today. And I don't have a computer, and I don't watch the news. And, you know, we live in a very techno-barbaric world, and that technology is slowly taking over every minute to the point where you don't have any time just to do anything. And the deal is I allow time to just do industrial amounts of nothing. And while I'm doing those industrial amounts of nothing, vast amount of things are being accomplished. You know, if you want to accomplish anything, you've got to learn to slow down. Because in the material world, you got to go faster to get where you need to go. In the spiritual world, you have to go much slower. You have to allow time to take over here. And what will happen is, as you slow down more and more, things begin to happen. You know, about 5 years ago, and I don't recommend this unless you're really serious, I came to the realization that a bunch of things had happened in my life. And I needed to do something right away for myself, for my own wellness, for my own creativity, for my own spontaneity. And so what I did was I gave away everything I owned. I mean everything, down to my shoes and socks and underwear. And I kept the clothes on my back and 6 boxes of pictures of family and kids. And I went and I lived on a Navajo reservation over in New Mexico. Now, I don't advise that to everybody unless you want to lose your mind. And people in my family said, we think you've lost your mind. And I said, thank you for the compliment, but not yet, but I'm really working on it. You know, like, I'm really working on it. And I learned a lot of good things being over there at the Navajo. First thing I learned is, if you do a rain dance long enough, you're going to get rain. These guys are just enlightened. You know, these guys are really... The other thing I learned is there was only one Thanksgiving, the first Thanksgiving. You never hear the second Thanksgiving. There was only one Thanksgiving. And the reason there was only one Thanksgiving is because the Native Americans thought it was a going away party. And they brought lots of food to see us off. And we didn't go. So they didn't come back the second year. So it was like there was only one Thanksgiving. And the other thing is that I learned is that the word vegetarian is a Native American word. In California, we have a lot of vegetarians, but I didn't know that was a Navajo word. And what it means is really bad hunter, you know? And and they taught me the simplicity, because I can remember a day where I went with a medicine man and we went up into the mountains there, the San Juan Mountains, and we were overlooking the San Juan River, which is a big trout river. And I sat down next to this Indian and we were drinking coffee, and we had gone up there to watch these eagles that just soar all over there, and the eagle is a big thing for the Indians. And anyway, we saw these guys fly fishing, and they do this thing called catch and release, where they catch it and then they just let it go. And I'm from Brooklyn. We do catch and fillet, you know, like a... So we watched these guys just doing this. And on this one occasion, this guy, he threw this thing in, he got a hit on it, he brought it in, and he released it. And it just swam away, and it swam maybe 25, 30 yards, and we were just focused on it. We didn't notice this eagle coming down. And this eagle just came down and dropped its talons into the water and snagged that fish and just took off with it. And this Indian medicine man turned around to me and he said, "White Pony Man," because that's what they call me, White Pony Man, Netcha. He said, "White Pony Man," he said, "did you ever have a day like that?" And I've had days like that, you know, where you think you're walking away from the scene of the accident and then you realize I am the accident, you know, like so you're not walking away from anything. And the funny thing about being in a simplistic environment is it seems like everything starts to move in slow motion. And nobody's in a hurry to do anything. And the whole tempo shuts down considerably. And you can feel, for the first time I felt, at a level I'd never felt before, a force that I had never acknowledged before. I paid a lot of lip service to a lot of things that I picked up in AA because people told me you needed these things to stay sober. And it wasn't like I was being hypocritical. I was just doing my best to get onto them. But it was there that I really reached the point where I began to feel that unmanifested part of myself that was connected to everything. And I began to slow down considerably. And the book talks about that in a lot of different ways. And one of the sentences it uses is that at some point, it says, deep down in each and every one of us is the fundamental idea of God. And it's only there that God can be found, the great reality. And for me, it was the greater reality. I had made up my own reality. I needed the greater reality. And what happened was, I have guys, and they say this to me, and maybe you'll hear this, that they say, "Ken, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God in every scenario, I'm going to become like the hole in the donut." Watch my lips, because this is very important. We are the hole in the donut. And thank God we are, because donuts come and go, but the hole is always there. And it's that hole that connects us to the unmanifested. It's that hole that connects me to the infinite. And if I don't feel that and don't experience that, then I'm just living in my own reality. I'm not living in the great reality. And it's very easy to do that. And you hear people say about, you know, living in the now is very difficult. And I say, well, I can't speak for anybody else. But for me, for years I read in this book that we suffer from a spiritual malady. And when that spiritual malady is overcome, we'll straighten out mentally and physically. Mentally and physically. And I didn't know what that spiritual malady was. I had some ideas about it, but I really couldn't pinpoint it. And now I can pinpoint it for me. And that is that spiritual malady is I was trying to live where I wasn't. I was so busy looking back and projecting out, I was never living in this moment. Subsequently, I was never with God, because God is always in this moment. And then I've read it thousands of times, hundreds of times, I should say, and it tells me in this book, There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday. You know, like, the deal is that God is always in the moment. And if I'm not in the moment, then I'm not with God. I'm someplace else creating my own reality. And it also says in the 12 and 12 in step 6, it says the difference between the men and the boys is the boys are working on their own personal objectives of what life should be. But the men are working on God's perfect objective. And you can live a good life in sobriety doing some fundamental things, but you're not necessarily doing God's will if the agenda is always yours. And Bill Wilson wrote about that. He even made a comment one time that the good is oftentimes the enemy of the best. And you can have what's good, but it may not be what's best for you until such time as you allow that to operate in your life. And the thing is that, you know, it's kind of like the lion story. They tell the lion story of the lion, you know, going up to the tiger and saying, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And the tiger says, "You, Mr. Lion." He says, "Don't forget it." And then he goes to the giraffe and he asks the same thing. "Who's the king of the jungle?" "You, Mr. Lion." He says, "Don't you forget it." And he does this to several more animals. And then finally he gets to the elephant and he said, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And the elephant picks the lion up by the tail, swings him over his head 4 or 5 times, tosses him 50 yards through the air. The lion hits a tree and slides down. And the elephant turns around and starts to walk away. And the lion gets up and brushes himself off and he says, "Hey, just because you don't know the right answer, that's no way to behave." You know, like, and that's the way it is in life. We're asking the wrong question and we're being tossed hither and fro by whatever comes up. And sooner or later you realize that there's two parts to you. There's the outside part and then there's the inside part. And when the inside part is okay, it doesn't matter what's going on the outside. And it doesn't matter what's going on the outside, and you heard the speaker share, that it doesn't matter what you get, whether it's money, power, prestige, or whatever, if you're not comfortable on the inside, you're never going to be comfortable. And I've had the experience of doing both, of having had some success on the outside and then having little successes on the inside, and tell you that on the inside is really where it counts, because a lot of things happened to me in my life, and what I realized is you can only lose what you do not own. You can't lose what you own. And if you own it on the inside, you can never lose it. In which case, you can go through life and just kind of have a good thing. But if everything is on the outside, it can come and go. I had a pension company, and I sold it off, and they gave me a lot of money. And they said, "You have your choice. Take it all in a lump sum or monthly." So I took it monthly. And for 12 years, they paid it to me. And then that company went bankrupt. And I had to go back to work in my late 50s because I didn't have anything. The pension was gone, and that was it. I was counting on that to take me through the rest of my life. And at that same time, the same year, my son came home, and he was in full-blown AIDS. And he stayed with me for 4 months, and I worked with him every day, doing the best I could for a disease that came in a different uniform every day, and finally he died. And I got to see what life is as far as even God had a sense of humor during that time, because when my wife and I divorced, the boys stayed with me. We stayed in the house, and I got to see those boys through high school and college. So I had a real good relationship with those kids. And when my son was sick, my ex-wife started coming to my house. I got to meet my husband-in-law, you know? And the thing was, is I got to see that when we're not in charge of really too much in life, we're not really in charge of a whole lot. And my son had reached a point, he went from 190 pounds down to about 80 pounds. And he wanted to maintain his dignity, so he wanted to use the bathroom. And I used to throw comforters and pillows and stuff on the floor so that he could crawl to the bathroom to maintain his dignity. And while he was crawling there, I thought, It's all perception. I crawled on the floor and I lost my dignity. My son is crawling on the floor to maintain his dignity. So it doesn't really matter what the action is, it's what's motivating you to that action. And we got him to a point where, he just couldn't make it. At that time, they didn't have the stuff they had today. That was back in 1993. And what happened was, when he was in the hospice unit, when I stopped working, I didn't know what to do with myself, so I started volunteering in the hospice program, working with people who were dying. And I didn't have an idea that 10 years after I started volunteering, I'd have to go back to work and my son would die in that hospice. And I remember a couple of days before he died, we stopped all the medication because it wasn't doing anything, and he had a moment of clarity, and he just woke up and he said, "Where am I, Dad, and what's going on?" And we had to tell him. And I got to see my son take his head and put it on one side of the pillow, and he was in this world. And when he brought it back, he was of this world. Because he said, "Thanks for being here. I really appreciate everything you've done. And I'm good to go, Dad." And I heard that with a clarity that I'll never forget, which is, from that day forward, I wanted to live my life to be good to go. I wanted to live my life in such a way that whenever that happened to me, whatever the date was, when my ticket got punched, I would have had the ride. And I would have made it the best ride I could. And you know, it's an amazing thing, because if you're going to be good to go, you got to be good to stay. And you've got to do the things you need to be here and to be happy, joyous, and free here. And the nice part about being sober is you get to do all these wonderful things. And you get to, as I said, hang out with these guys who are just crazy. And you get to be part of stuff. You know, you get to be part of stuff. I sponsor a guy. You won't hear this on CNN or the news, but he's a Persian, and he just came back from Iran. And AA is now about 3 or 4 years old in Iran. And in the capital city of Tehran, they just had a convention. 25,000 people attended that convention. They hold the meetings in the mosque, and women who can't go into the mosque to pray go into the mosque for AA. And the deal is that it's all in Farsi. All the literature now is in Farsi, and these folks are just on the move, getting into AA and getting into the spiritual wellness of life. And the deal is he comes to my house, and he's an interesting guy because, you know, he's Persian born and raised, and then over here, since the Shah left in 79, and I had a guy come to my house during the football season last year, and this guy came to my house, and his sponsor had sent him to me because he was new, and he said, "Go talk to Ken about God." So he came over, and he said, "I need to talk to you about God." And I said, "Well, we got to talk fast, because the game's going to go on, and a bunch of guys are going to show up here with pizza." And he said, I said, "So we got to talk pretty fast." And he sat down and he started to do what alcoholics do, and that is he formed a problem that was so elaborate that you thought, "Oh, this is so terrible. I don't even see an end to it." You know? And just then, I forgot to tell him that Sam was in the bedroom, and Sam had to pray because the sun was going down. So all of a sudden from the bedroom we hear, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." And he says, "What the hell is that?" And I said, "That's Sam. He found God." You know, this guy ran out of my house, and neither me or his sponsor have seen him since. We have no idea where he is, but we hope he's sober, you know. So life just comes on and takes on a whole different meaning, and all kinds of things start to happen. And you know, you realize you're not in charge of anything. We're like a flea on a log going down a river. And every now and again, the flea, you know, the log goes around a bend in the river, and we think we're steering. You know, just, you know. And if you're an alcoholic, you buy a commander's whistle and a hat, you know, because you want them to open the bridge and do stuff. Like, "Hey, open the bridge." You know. Alcoholics are of the mind that there's a song for alcoholics and their best ideas, and the song goes like this: dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum 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 dum. And then it says, let me share. Boom! You know, that's the way it goes. You know? And that's just the way it happens. Now, I'm gonna give you guys a tool that I use with these guys, because these guys are not the brightest bulbs in the room, you know. And if you like it, take it. If you don't like it, don't take it. But how many of you, if you were going to open a bottle of ketchup or something, which is your strongest hand, your right hand or your left hand? You guys would know that. How many say right hand? Let's say your hands. Okay, how many say left hand? Okay, some of you not too sure. Okay, good. Okay. No, I'm non-committal. This is only my third convention. I'm not committing to anything. I'm just here for the dance. I didn't know it was a question and answer period. Is this a workshop? You know? Do we have to form a focus group? You know. Okay, so now put your hands together and push as hard as you can. Which hand wins? And you know what? Neither hand can win. And the reason neither hand can win is because all the power is coming from the same place. So the power to change is being met by an equal power not to change. And you can't overcome yourself. And don't feel bad. Nobody else in the room can either. You know, if we could overcome ourselves, we wouldn't have to do this. We would just say, hey, drinking's a problem. I'm stopping. You know? My wife told me that's my second drink, and geez, I could surely get away with none. You know, like, golly, Ken, why would you be doing that if it's upsetting the honey? You know, like, you know, come on. But we can do it because we can't overcome ourselves. So what we teach people in AA, hopefully, is to relax those hands and ask for that power that's greater than yourself to come into your life and make you conscious of it. Get conscious of it so that you can do all these things you need to do. And in the meantime, stop doing all the trivial stuff. You know, like, I give out a lot of Q-tips. You guys do Q-tips here? You got to start, get a box of Q-tips, take them to a meeting. When these people start, give them a Q-tip. It stands for quit taking it personally. You know, just here, there's a Q-tip for you. You know, we haven't, you know, the whole world hasn't conspired to ruin your day. You know, like, we left that to you. You know, like, I've been thinking. Good, you know. And if you're new, how many people have less than a year in here? Oh, good. Welcome to AA, first of all. But if you have less than a year, for the next few months, you're going to think that we're laughing at you. And you're going to be absolutely right. And it's not that we're laughing at your problems. We're laughing at your solutions, you know? But somehow the word more is always in there. If I just had more, more, more. You know, the logo for AA should be excess is not enough. You know, like we need more. And I'll tell you, this sobriety lights up so many things. I used to be afraid of dogs. I mean really afraid of dogs. I was bit about 4 times by dogs. It always seemed they were trying to keep me out of places I was trying to get into. You know. I went through a period in my life where I used to try to find things before people officially lost them. And I was bitten by these dogs 4 different times. And so I had a terrible fear of dogs. And a couple of months ago, I'm going down the road, and I'm looking in my rearview mirror, and what do I see but a Rottweiler chasing after my car. And it's a hot day. It's like in the 90s. And so I see him, and I pull to the side of the road. And I don't know if you know what a rot. It's like a Doberman on steroids. You know, it's a good sized dog. He's got a head like this. And this dog ran up to the car, and I pushed down the window, and he just stood there looking at me, going. And I said, "What now? What now?" And he just looked at me, and just for that moment. He and I were on the exact same wavelength. That dog knew I had chased after a lot of shit in my life, having no idea what I was going to do when I caught it. And he knew that I knew that he was going through the same thing. And so we just kind of just kept good eye contact for a minute, and I said, hey, catch your breath, first of all. You know? And then hang in there, you know, maybe you'll catch a Volkswagen or something. You know, like this. But when I left, that dog, he knew I knew. He knew I knew, you know. And I have that kind of deal now with all kinds of animals. I used to be, all, as I said, intimidated by all that stuff, and now I'm just at peace with it. I'm at peace with a lot of stuff that used to just bother me. You know, I'm in line now. I can go to sleep in the 10 or less items line if somebody writes a check. That's how comfortable I am, you know. And I still notice stuff. You know, I was in line the other day at the store, and I noticed that they sell the batteries there, and I thought, wait a second, there are no B batteries. There are A batteries, there are C batteries, there are double D's, triple D's. There's no B's, it begins with a B. So when I get up to the little checkout gal, I make her aware of this stuff. You know, I said, do you realize there are no B batteries? And she said, I'll give you the double coupons, just keep moving, you know. Like, you know, and so, like, you know, so even today I can click into stuff, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. And I still hear stuff that makes no sense to me, like, attention Walmart shoppers. Who else would be in Walmart? You know, like, do they think people are sneaking over from Kmart or what? Like, you know, like, it makes absolutely no sense, you know. You go to federal buildings where there's doors that says, do not open this door at any time. Well, why have this door? You know, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, we're not the only ones, you know. And I hear people say, well, there's us in here, and then there are the normal people out there. Watch my lips. There are no normal people. There are just people who haven't shared with you. And once they share with you, you go, hey. hang in there, you know. You know. I mean, you ever see what normal people buy? They buy things like mint-flavored dog biscuits. I want my dog to have good breath. I'll put Lavoris in the toilet. You know, like, I don't need to, you know. The reality of this is that it's an amazing thing that we don't have a lock on insanity. There's a lot of it to go around. But we get to hear about it because we share about it, you know, and the other folks just don't. So my whole deal to you guys is that none of us sitting in this room or standing in this room has any idea what our distance is between the time we were born and the time we die. There's a dash in there. We're all along in the dash. Some of us may have a little bit of time left. Some of us may have a lot, but we don't know. So the whole idea is to make it count for something. And the best way to make it count for something is to develop a ritual where you actually start thinking of other people and trying to help other people. And in doing that, what you'll notice is your own life will take care of itself. And you'll start to find a peace which this world can't give and it can't take away. And you'll start to become very grateful. And that's a prayer I can say all the time. There are some prayers I have trouble saying because I have to allow time for them. But being grateful you can do all the time. And being grateful is just thanking God for what is and not saying, I need more. I'm thankful for everything you've given me. Even if I don't understand what it's all about, I'm thankful for the gift. And it's a way of life. And you'll notice something. Trust me on this, if you haven't experienced it, is people think that you find God and then you get grateful. That's not the way it works. You get grateful and then you find God. The more grateful you are, the more God will come into your life. The more you're saying, well, I can't do this until I get God, then you're going to be postponing a lot of stuff. And remember the three basic rules, you know, don't scratch shit that don't itch, you know, don't be milking a mouse, you know, don't get into getting one little thing in your life, well, you don't understand, I got to work. You know? Milking a mouse is a lot of activity, but it creates very little milk, you know. And remember, there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Okay, I'm going to give you 2 minutes now to get your targets. Okay. And I'm going to thank everybody for letting me come here and be part of this. It's been a really, really great weekend. And I want to tell you something that I know factually, and that is God is in such hot pursuit of each and every one of us that none of us escape. You don't have to worry. You don't have to find him. He's in hot pursuit of you. Very much so. You don't have to worry about, you know, not him not catching up with you. And the other thing is, through each and every one of us, God is trying to become something he's never been before. And our job is not to impede him, to allow that to happen. Whatever you want to do with me, Lord, take me. Use me in whatever fashion you want. I have nothing else to do but to be of service. There isn't a thing on this earth more important than being there for you. And if I fail, please, please offer me a second chance. And I got that second chance in rooms like this all over this country. And I got to laugh a lot. And you know who I laugh at the most? Myself. Myself. I was in Monterey a couple of months ago, and they had a convention there, and I was on the John, and I was, the closets had all mirrors. And I looked up, and I got to see myself the way I really am. And I heard myself say out loud, when the hell did this happen? You know, like, when the hell? You know? And that night when I shared that. And there were about 25 people who came up afterward and said they had the same experience. And we were all in the same age group. You know, like, you just look and you say, when did this happen? You know, this is embarrassing. You know, like, you know. I waited all my life wondering how it was going to turn out, and this is what's happened, you know. This is what I was worried about, you know, like. And the last thing, and this is really, really important, is that we have to take really good care of one another because we're only on loan. We're only on loan. So if someone's in your life today, be really, really gentle with them. Be really, really giving to them. Because they may not be there tomorrow. There's no guarantees about this. So I want to thank you for letting me come. I want to say God bless you, and I like to say the word namaste. And namaste is a Hindu word, which I got from one of the guys who I sponsored. And namaste means the God in me sees the God in you. And as long as the God in me sees the God in you, and the God in you sees the God in me, we don't have any worries. God bless you.